This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
This talk was given by Dr. Joe Michel of the University of the West of England on Dr. Piketty on Wealth and Capital.
Okay, thanks very much, Engelbert, for the introduction. I'm very pleased to see so many people here on this lovely summer day in London for this workshop. Okay, so the first presentation I'm going to talk about Mr. Piketty's famous book. I wrote this a while ago now, and actually there's been a lot more discussion since, but I still think some of the things that I say probably haven't been said, at least in quite the form I'm going to say them. So there is Dr. Piketty. Before I start, I want to say that I think that he's done us a tremendous favour by kicking open the door to this conversation that we've been trying to have for a long time about distribution and inequality and so on. So my criticism should be taken in the spirit of friendly discussion rather than an attempt to foment disruption among essentially friendly thinkers. But I think there are some, particularly in his analytical work, some problems which are worth discussing, particularly the distinction between real capital accumulation and financial and monetary processes. So that's what I want to focus on with this discussion. This is just some of the praise that Piketty has received. I guess much of this is going to be familiar to people by now, but I'll quickly run through the broad contours of Piketty's argument. Somebody said to me at a conference that Piketty is a bit like one of these Rorschach blots in that there's a sort of looseness to the way it's presented and written, and the fact that many people don't read it, they only read the reviews and so on, that you can read almost anything you want into it. You can turn Piketty into what you want it to be. For example, Paul Mason's review in The Guardian, I only came across the last few days, he explicitly says financial capital all the way through his review when talking about Piketty. So he's talking about accumulation of financial wealth. To me, it's very clear that this is exactly not what Piketty is doing. But there are lots of examples of this where people just, they have their own view on, you know, what is happening in modern capitalism, and then they read Piketty and they use Piketty to say, well, this is my view all along. So I'm trying to sort of get to the heart of what Piketty actually is saying and raise some issues about that. And really what Piketty is talking about is capital accumulation. And it's quite clear, I'm going to try and convince you, that he's talking about real capital accumulation, physical capital stocks. And I can show that on this basis, his theory doesn't really make sense, particularly that R is greater than G, sort of core piece of his argument, has a kind of logical fallacy. And then building on that, I'm going to show that we can actually recalculate some of the data series he uses to back up his assertions. And I'm going to argue that these data series do not measure what he says they measure. He says they measure the accumulation of capital over the last 50 years or 100 years. I'm going to argue that they measure a number of things, mostly price effects on stock markets and housing. They actually measure statistical discrepancies in some of the accounts he's drawing on, such as the flow of funds accounts, and they measure a shift in ownership from public to private. And once you sort of filter out all of these things, each of which had a relatively small but significant error, you get quite different empirical results. I will quickly run through the empirics. These should be very familiar to most people here. Essentially, a trend fall in the wage share since around the 1970s in many of the advanced economies. We have had lots of work on that from people here, such as Engelbert and Oslem, on wage-led versus profit-led growth. And then what Piketty brings to this is detailed data on the personal distribution of income, and this famous U-shaped graph of the top 1% share in the United States. Okay, so what is Piketty's theory? Piketty's theory really comes down to these three equations. Two of them he calls the laws of capitalism, and the third he calls the fundamental force four divergents. So the first law of capitalism is that the capital income equals the rate of profit times the capital output ratio. The second law is that the capital output ratio is determined by the rate of saving and the growth rate, and these are exogenous. And then he sort of asserts that, well, the rate of profit or the rate of return on capital, if we're thinking in a neoclassical world, which I'm going to try and convince you Piketty is, remains above the rate of growth. And from this, the rest of his results drop out. Now, when I first looked at these equations, I found them a little hard to know what to deal with. And then it occurred to me that I could replace alpha and beta with things which I could recognize. And then suddenly I found it a lot easier to think about. So if we replace the share of profits in income and the capital output ratio with the relevant ratios, things start to look a bit more familiar. And in fact, we can rearrange that first identity, and lots of people have now noted that it's simply an accounting definition of the rate of profit. It is profits in income divided by some measure of the capital stock. The second law of capitalism, how am I doing for time, also looks more familiar in this form, but if you rearrange it, it becomes the Harrod-Domar or Solow growth equation. And there's not much more we can do with the third, the force for divergence. But these things somehow seem slightly less profound when you realise that one is just simply the definition of the rate of profit and the other is the Solow or Harrod-Domar growth equation. So how does Piketty use these three equations to explain his results? So we assume that the growth G is determined by exogenous population growth. Saving rates is exogenous. This is all sort of standard. It's basically the Solow growth model, the Solow neoclassical growth model. The one thing we have to adjust is that the Solow growth model sort of tends to be based on the idea of a Cobb-Douglas production function. And a Cobb-Douglas production function, by its construction, fixes the share of capital and labour. You can't have a change in the capital-labour share in a Cobb-Douglas production function, because as the price of capital changes, the amount used adjusts exactly to offset that change. So the change that is introduced here is the assertion of a constant elasticity of substitution, between capital and labour, and Piketty asserts that this elasticity is greater than one. Therefore, the first law of capitalism will determine the distribution between labour and capital, and because of this elasticity of substitution greater than one, R doesn't fall. The rate of profit or the rate of return on capital doesn't fall as you accumulate capital to a degree that would reduce the capital share, and it remains above the growth rate, and this explains increasing dispersion within population, so both within households and individuals. So this is a sort of micro level story. R greater than G means that those who already have capital see their capital growing faster than those who don't have capital. So growing inequality is caused by a high saving rate and a low growth rate, essentially, alongside the assertion that the elasticity of capital and labour is greater than one. So it's a crisis of over-accumulation, you know, too much capital investment, excessive growth of the capital stock. So this is the claim that I want to probe. I started at 10, is that right? So I have another
7 minutes.
Wow. I need to speed up. Okay, I'm going to just give you a couple of quotes, because sometimes when I produce this stuff, people say, oh, no, he doesn't really have this neoclassical growth model behind, you know, he understands this isn't really how the world works. So some quotes just to, I think, reinforce the view that he really does think that this is the theoretical framework. So Harrod-Domar introduced the idea, but really Solow was the one, by introducing substitutability between capital and labour, who made it usable. And the interesting question is not whether the marginal product decreases, but how fast it decreases. This is the R greater than G. Why doesn't R come down as we accumulate capital? And here is the crux of the matter. It's really quite hard to find a justification for this. Why doesn't R fall? The answer is there are many uses for capital in the long run. Capital is a useful thing. People want to use it. I mean, I really think if you dig, you can't find another explanation in Piketty beyond this for why R remains above G. And I've already said this. Once R remains above G, then those people who own capital will see their wealth rise faster than others. So that's a little schematic of how the model works. Here, then, is the evidence presented to back up this assertion. Rising capital income ratios for the major economies, slightly different trajectories, but a clear pattern for all of them. I'm going to skip over these a little bit, other than to say that Piketty says, I use the words capital and wealth interchangeably as if they were perfectly synonymous. And this, I think, is unsatisfactory. I'm going to skip over the capital controversies, other than to note that Piketty explicitly and clearly says that it wasn't until the 70s when Solow definitively ruled the roost and showed that the Cambridge Keynesians had been deluded in their attempt to attack the neoclassical production function. And I'm going to try and contrast this with financial wealth. And I've got a quote from Engelbert here saying that financial investment is a transfer of assets, not a use of income. Buying financial assets transfers liquidity from one agent to another, but cannot substitute for physical investment. And I think a lot of what Piketty is measuring is accumulation of financial claims. Okay, let's probe R greater than G in 1 minute. And assume a closed economy without government, and just start from the straightforward accounting identities that income is equal to profits plus wages, is also equal to investment plus consumption. Rearrange that, divide through by K, and you find that the rate of return on capital, or the rate of profit, is equal to, by definition, the rate of growth plus the dissaving of workers, essentially. This is a sort of Kaletskian type of result. Very straightforward to show that once you have... what you cannot have is a situation where everybody saves out of their capital and therefore accumulates capital at a greater rate. Because the more that capitalists try and save, the more they reduce the rate of return on capital. To the point that if they save all of their capital income, then the rate of growth by definition, by purely accounting definition, is equal to the rate of return on capital. So there's a pure fallacy of composition in this argument. So it requires dissaving somewhere in the economy, or it requires spending out of capital income, capitalist consumption. We can extend this to an open economy or with a government sector. Then you can maintain profits either through deficit spending or through running an export surplus. This is Kaletsky's internal exports, or Rosa Luxemburg's profit realization through external surplus. What I've just shown you, though, it assumes steady state growth. It assumes a capital income ratio which is constant. And we can loosen that assertion and mathematically find that if the capital output ratio is rising, then this result doesn't hold. You can have R greater than G over that period. So this brings us back to the same question. Do we have a rising capital outcome ratio, i.e. do we have high investment and saving, high accumulation of capital, and so on. I have 2 minutes. It's difficult to measure. First piece of evidence is that the net saving, and given that saving and investment, excluding the external sector, are by definition ex post equal, you would expect to have some relevance. So the net saving of the advanced economies, other than Germany, from the period of the Eurozone, there's a remarkable right angle in that series, has been on a trend decline. So it's hard to see how we have a problem of excess saving, which is Piketty's argument. How then do we measure the capital stock. I mean, that's the flow, the saving, net saving is the flow. What we're trying to measure is the stock here. And I've come up with a way of both reproducing Piketty's data series from the flow of funds accounts. One thing he's very good on is providing exactly how he's calculated the data and his spreadsheet. So I've reproduced his data series, and then I've produced my own based on a different definition of the capital stock. And I've essentially defined the national capital stock as how much capital is held by households and firms plus the external position. I will skip a couple of slides here. This is the consolidated balance sheet of the non-financial corporate sector. And the thing I want to highlight here is both the rise in the holdings of financial assets of the sector and the change in the net worth of the sector, which is a sort of Tobin's Q type of effect. And both of these things feed into Piketty's measure of so-called capital. This is the flow of funds for the US as a whole, and the black line here is what I'm interested in. It's the statistical discrepancy. The things don't sum to zero. And the way Piketty defines his series, this gets added onto his capital stock measure. Finally, the distribution of ownership between the public and the private sector through privatizations and so on has changed significantly over the period. So if you look at the private wealth, then it appears to grow, but it's not because of accumulation, it's simply because of a transfer of ownership. So I argue that the series are skewed by these phenomena: house prices, equity prices, statistical discrepancies, and transfer of assets from the public to the private sector. And if we recalculate Piketty's capital series, I come up with this red line here. Now, I can't knock out the price effects of housing. That's the one thing I can't knock out from these series. So there are two humps. The second hump is definitely a housing bubble in the US. But there's no clear rising trend. If anything, it's falling, which is what you would expect because we know that investment is low. There's secular decline in fixed capital investment. And I've done the same thing for the UK. Okay, I'm 2 minutes over. So that's all I have to say. I've run through that rather quickly. There is more detail in there, which I can make available. But essentially what I'm saying is there's something else driving income inequality, and it's not a crisis of overaccumulation. It's not an excess of capital stock. My view is it's something to do with forces which reduce labour income alongside forces which give some kind of financial dynamics and lead to accumulation of financial claims, asset price inflation, and so on. But that's a discussion for another day.